Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jason Ophir, and we are back for another episode of Paranormal Horizons. And I'm here, as always, with the beautiful and talented Sherry Pang. Sherry, how's it going?
Hey, pretty good. How are you, Jason? How's your week?
It's actually not too bad. Nothing terrible happened. It's been pretty uneventful, just spending the weekend relaxing. How was yours?
Good. Very good. I've just been busy working, and I've just been, you know, it's been nonstop. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, I've been just kind of hanging out and doing my usual work thing. I work so much in such weird hours that I've decided I want to retire somehow. I want to be rich and famous. So if anybody can make that happen, well, I don't have to be famous. I just want to be rich because I decided I don't want to work anymore.
So you need to hit the lottery.
Yeah. So if anybody could select some lucky numbers for like Powerball or whatever, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah. That would be great. That's what my son said. Hey, if I can get a million, I asked him, what do you want for Christmas? And he said $1 million.
Yeah, $1 million. That'd be great. Hey, but I noticed
something.
Yeah, that
would be awesome. You know, I feel very blessed and what I have, what I do have, I'm just grateful. And I would like to share the wealth, whatever, you know, little money I have or, you know, whatever. To me, it's all about sharing.
Well, you're only going to get good karma from sharing. I'm still a believer in karma, you know, the energy that you put out there. If you treat people well, you do nice things for people, I do believe it comes back to you.
That's true. That's very, very true. I'm going to go and introduce our guest tonight. Neil McNeil, he is just a really nice guy. I think we've had him in our show probably about, 7 or 8 months ago, and I forgot what we talked about, but he has a wealth of information. He has classes in parapsychology. He has a study of PSI phenomenon, including current theories about ESP, psychokinesis, and the survival of bodily death, the nature of hauntings, apparitions, poltergeists. And anyway, we're going to talk about, when I looked at his bio and I kind of figured, okay, what we're going to talk about, I think that we're going to talk about tonight about what, about ghosts. What do they want us to talk about? What do ghosts want? That's kind of interesting because I thought, what do ghosts want? You know, and I can't interject what I have to say because it's not a reading, but this is going to be very interesting in how somebody else's take of what do ghosts want. This is going to be quite interesting, and if anybody would like to call in, they can call in at 1-215-383-3999. So if you want to call in again, it's 1-215-383-3999.
Absolutely. And I wanted to mention one more thing before we bring our guest on, and something I just briefly mentioned to you prior to the show starting is I just noticed that if you go to the Blog Talk Radio site and you type in the search bar paranormal, it comes up with 83,000 results. And Paranormal Horizons is the third thing that pulls up. And I thought that was pretty cool that if anybody types in the word paranormal, we're the third thing that shows up out of 83,000 possibilities.
Wow, that is wonderful. I feel so blessed. And without you, Jason, we don't have – without you and also the listeners and our guests, they are the ones that make this radio show successful, and we're going to continue in being successful. So I feel very blessed.
Absolutely. And with that final thought, we'll go ahead and bring our guest on.
Yay.
Hey.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Sherry. Hi, Jason. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
Great. Happy almost holidays to you.
You too.
I know.
You too. Are you getting ready for the holidays? Are you in the spirit or?
Was that a pun in the spirit? Yes, actually, getting into the spirit, getting into the spirit of Christmas. Christmas, actually, you know, the holidays have one of my absolute favorite ghost stories of all time, and of course, that's A Christmas Carol, because you have no less than four different ghosts in that story. Isn't that great? Nobody ever thinks of that.
Well, I'm going to have to check that one out, okay?
Nobody thinks about it.
Go ahead.
You're not familiar with A Christmas Carol?
No.
Have you never read the Dickens? Oh, yeah, that's something you got to do this holiday. Great, great ghost story.
I'm guilty, no.
I am the ghost of Christmas past. So we're excited to talk to you this evening. I guess we kind of just a free-for-all. We're going to talk about ghosts and what ghosts want. And I guess before we do that, maybe you could give a kind of more expanded bio for our listeners this evening.
Oh, is that me? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, I've actually been in the field of paranormal research and parapsychology for 25 years. I started back in California in 1993, where I happened to meet parapsychologist Lloyd Auerbach, pretty much the Sam Spade of paranormal investigators, as he was called at the time. And once I met him and realized that there was this whole scientific field of inquiry into apparitions and hauntings and poltergeist phenomena and psychic phenomena, I just never looked back. I basically read everything I could. I took all the classes that I could, and here I am 25 years later, and I'm teaching those classes in parapsychology, which is really fun for me to do. And also on the lecture circuit, just trying to educate people on the science behind paranormal phenomena, because most folks, I believe, don't realize that there's, you know, well over 130 years worth of scientific research, and I'm talking about research both in the field and in the laboratory, that basically shows us there's very little doubt at this point that psychic phenomena of a sort do exist, that people do have ghost encounters and people do experience poltergeist phenomena, that this is not stuff from the crackpot set. This actually has some validity to it, and that's the exciting thing about it. So that's pretty much what I do these days. I do a lot of education, a lot of talking, a lot of lectures and things like that. That's what I spend most of my time doing.
So what
Neil,
kind of...
can I ask you, what do ghosts want? I'm curious.
Well, you know, personally, if I was a ghost, I'd probably want a new bed sheet. You know, if you're if you're haunting someplace for a couple of decades, wearing that sheet just gets kind of boring. No. Seriously, I think ghosts want the same thing that the living want. If we take a look and we listen to the stories that people tell of their encounters with apparitions and hauntings, basically it seems like the intelligent encounters, the actual apparitions, basically want the same things that we do. They seem to want to be in a place that means something to them. They seem to want to, in most cases, carry on as they did in real life, and that can take a number of different forms. That can be that they want to continue the actual work. They kind of go through the pantomime of doing what they did in real life, maybe in work, maybe in play. It definitely seems that there are things that survive the death of the physical body, like sense of humor, little personality quirks and idiosyncrasies, because all ghosts are different. We have many cases on record of people who actually knew the ghost when they were alive, when the person was actually living, and they're able to confirm that the behaviors that those ghosts have actually match the person that they knew in real life. So we're not that far removed. I think, you know, I'm very fond of telling my students and folks that I talk to that ghosts are people too. The only difference is they're dead and we're not. And frankly, some of the dead are more interesting than many of the living that I've met over the last several years. But that's a whole different show, I guess.
So in your experience, ghosts that really do exist, it's not a figment of our mind or anything like that. And you were talking about you know, over 100 years of science behind it. What sort of science that exists today or even in the past that actually confirms that spirits are real?
Well, that's a really good question, and there's a couple different ways to answer that. Depending on whether or not you believe in what's called the spirit hypothesis, that is, that there is a physical manifestation or an almost physical manifestation of somebody's soul or spirit or whatever you want to call it that survives the death of the body. Or there is the hallucination theory, which is that, yeah, you can still have that consciousness that survives death, but it doesn't really have the ability to do much, like appear to people or move objects or things like that. So when we encounter one of these sort of invisible minds that's running around, we basically are using our own psychic abilities, latent psychic abilities, to create the physical perception that we're actually meeting a ghost. So these are the two theories that basically have come down to us through the last 100 so years, that either there is a physical ghost that, you know, the soul has left the body, soul has left the building and it's still hanging around, or that we are encountering that spirit and we are creating, using our own mind, creating this, for lack of a better term, hallucination that we describe as a ghost. Parapsychology, of course, the science that studies these phenomena, tends to believe the latter model, the model that we are using our own latent psychic abilities, our own abilities to create these manifestations in our own mind, because that tends to explain certain things like, you know, if a ghost appears to 12 different people at the same time, not everybody experiences that ghost the same way. There are major discrepancies oftentimes. Some people will only see the ghost, some people hear the ghost, some people only sense the ghost, some people don't see or sense them at all. And so if we look at the idea that it's actually a psychological phenomena that's happening within us, that can really explain some of those discrepancies. So that's kind of the side that I come down on. But there is a lot of evidence in support actually of both sides that does come down to us for the last 120, 130 years. If we take it all the way back to the very beginning of the actual valid research, the scientific research, where we look at things like the Society for Psychical Research and the American Society for Psychical Research. These were scholars and men and women of science at the time, the turn of the century, that were going out into the field and gathering people's ghost stories, their brushes with the dead or with psychic phenomena like telepathy, thought transference, those kinds of things. And they cataloged and recorded these things. And by doing so, they were able to look at, you know, vast numbers of cases. And in some of their studies, take a book that they put out called Phantasms of the Living from 1886. This looked at 701 documented cases of apparitions from the general public. These weren't just, you know, your general run-of-the-mill spontaneous cases. These were the ones that they had, out of thousands of cases, determined were valid representations of apparitional encounters. And some of the things that they found basically went against what the common perception of a ghost was. In other words, just kind of like today, if you ask somebody, well, what's a paranormal experience like, or what is it like to run into a ghost? Most people are conditioned by the media and will say that, well, it's scary, it's frightening, they're out to get you, they're out to possess you, they're out to hide your car keys, you know, these kinds of things. It's a negative connotation. It's a frightening thing that we should be aware of and be scared of and hopefully never encounter in our lifetime. But the Society for Psychical Research, when they looked at all these different cases, they found that actually when they talked to real people who had real encounters, that the opposite was actually true. That in most of these cases, these 701 cases, for instance, it was not a scary experience that people were reporting. It was actually a comforting and soothing experience, because many of those ghostly encounters happened after somebody that they knew had passed away. And so the ghost, it seemed, ostensibly was coming back to let them know that they're okay. They made it to the other side, everything is fine, and the living don't have to worry about them anymore. It also sort of went against a lot of the, again, a lot of the details of ghost experiences that people kind of take for granted, that it has to happen on a dark and stormy night. It has to happen at the witching hour, all of those kinds of things. And again, when they really looked at what people were experiencing out in the real world, it was anything but that. It usually happened in very humdrum, ordinary settings. You could run into a ghost at work. You could run into a ghost at home. Usually it was the everyday surroundings, and you were in a very relaxed situation. You weren't expecting a ghost. So the 700 cases that they looked at, people weren't going to haunted houses. They were at home, and these ghosts would show up. So things like this began to give us an idea that what the popular concept of a ghost or an apparition actually was, wasn't the truth. And so these cases gave us a lot of information and a lot of data that still holds up today. If you look at people's reports today that are researched by scientists, by parapsychologists or professional paranormal investigators, they say the same thing too. It isn't demonic infestation that you have. It's the ghost of your great aunt Griselda who's come back to just let you know that she left the will under the floorboard, you know, those kinds of things. So this is the kind of evidence we get. It's anecdotal, it's empirical evidence, but that doesn't invalidate it. It is still data. It is still evidence that supports the idea that something actually does survive the death of the physical body.
I know I've done a lot of paranormal investigations, and there's a lot of things that I can't explain. A lot of things I was able to debunk, but like I would be researching stuff or listening to audio and get these EVPs that seemed intelligent, and it was really hard for me to, you know, explain them away. And so I believe that there's something out there, and I know the government spent a lot of money doing some psychical research with remote viewing. So it almost makes me think that, well, if the government's spending money and resources looking into things, maybe there is something behind the paranormal or psychic phenomena and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, the U.S. government, actually there are other world governments, but the U.S. government it's been known for some time that they ran and are still currently running, probably, all kinds of research into all kinds of different psychic phenomena. So whether that's remote viewing or remote sensing, or whether that's telepathic exchange or any of those kinds of things, if they're interested in it, they've got their reasons, then there probably is something to it. Now, if you know, the studies that you were referring to in remote viewing, basically what constituted the Stargate project that ran during the Cold War for about 25 years, the results of those findings basically show that, yeah, remote viewing as a psychic phenomenon does exist and people can learn how to do it. But the government in the end said basically, well, yeah, but it doesn't really have any application. There's no practical application for it. So we're not going to continue to study it. So, you know, take your pick as to which answer they give. But yeah, I take your point. It is absolutely proof, or at least evidence, that there really is something going on here, and it is important, and it is important to look into and research scientifically. You mentioned electronic voice phenomena, which a lot of people point to, a lot of paranormal investigators point to as some of the best evidence that we have that we can look at, get our hands on, listen to, run through computers and analyze for the existence of apparitions, for the existence of ghosts. And again, there are two schools of thought on this. Yes, it's possible. It is possible that ghosts can somehow or another speak through recordings, either digital recordings or, as old dogs in paranormal investigation like me used to use, reel-to-reel tape, you know, that magnetic tape, that for whatever reason they're able to leave these messages, very short in duration, usually just a couple of words, oftentimes very strained or whispered, And it's quite startling when you listen to these sorts of things. So it is possible that ghosts are able to do that. How they're able to do that, we're not exactly sure. But there is another theory, one that I tend to subscribe to, that I believe a lot, not all, but a lot, a majority of EVP that people gather isn't necessarily evidence of the apparition as much as it is evidence of the person, the living person who was making the recording. So if you remember, I said earlier that the psychological model that we use, parapsychology uses to explain apparitions, we're using our psychic abilities to create this visual or audio hallucination that's very real of this apparition. The same thing can be done with psychokinesis. Psychokinesis, of course, is mind over matter, being able to basically physically affect your environment using nothing but the power of your mind, whether that's intentional or subconscious, as we do have examples of both of those things. It's just as possible that the paranormal investigator is responsible for that EVP recording as it is the apparition being responsible for that recording. So while I really find electronic voice phenomena and electronic audio phenomena to be fascinating, and I really think that they do show in many cases that something very bizarre, very interesting is going on that is beyond beyond what we can explain at this point, I have to kind of stop short of saying that that is proof of an apparition, because I don't know if that apparition can actually physically affect my tape recorder or my digital recorder. But I know that using psychokinesis, even unintentionally, I can affect those machines, because we have lots of evidence that points to that, that the living are able to affect machines, recordings, computers, cell phones, all that sort of thing. So again, it's fascinating, and we kind of have to take a step back and say, yeah, I think that's a really interesting recording that I got that says, you know, hello, I'm fine. But again, is that really the apparition that's causing that recording, or is that the paranormal investigator? Either way, it's absolutely fascinating. So take your
time. Wow, that's a very good take on that, Neil. I never thought about it in that perspective.
One of the things that I really try to do is get amateur paranormal investigators, the amateur groups, and even the professional groups who don't really understand that they do have the ability to affect their environment and electronic devices. That obviously includes recorders and cameras and electronic EMF field meters and things like that. All of the equipment that they generally take out for investigation, they do have the ability to psychokinetically affect the results of those readings. So you do sort of have to be careful when you're doing field investigation that you don't just come right down on the side of, yep, that's the apparition that's giving me that recording. So there's definite proof that that apparition is there. We can't really say that for sure.
Well, how can you tell the difference? How, in your position, how would you be able to know if it's real or not? Or you're, you know, like you said, it's either through the apparition or the field investigator.
Well, unfortunately, in order to really answer that, when you've got to have a more controlled environment than most investigators have when they're out in the field, because, you know, if you're going to a haunted house and you're doing investigation, or if somebody calls you up saying, I think I've got a ghost in my house, and you go out to do the investigation, there's really only so much control that you have over that environment. It's not like being in a laboratory setting where you can account for variables. But having said that, if the information in the recordings that you're getting back isn't generally known to any of the investigators, in other words, if we're able to send the investigators in blind with no prior knowledge of what has been reported as paranormal phenomena in that location, then we stand a much better chance of saying that any, for example, electronic voice phenomena that we get isn't the living imprinting that on the recording, that it is probably the apparition that is doing that, because you would have to have that knowledge or you would have to have somebody with that knowledge that is telepathically transmitting it to the paranormal investigators. You see, this is where it becomes very complicated, because if just one person has that information, they could be leaking it to the paranormal investigation group, the investigators themselves, subconsciously through telepathy, not even realizing that they're doing it. Telepathy works over great distances. It works instantaneously, and you don't always have to be aware that you're doing it in order for it to work. So it is very difficult to account for those kinds of variables when you're in the field to say, yeah, this particular EVP is not our paranormal investigators. It actually is an apparition. So these are the problems that we have in parapsychology. They're fascinating, but the experimental designs that we have to come up with. There's a reason why we use triple blind studies in parapsychology, why parapsychology is really one of the only sciences that uses triple blind protocols, because we have to account for things like telepathic leak and all of those sorts of things. It can be very, very tricky.
I mean, I'm totally with you on the mind affecting things. I am a real big believer that we have untapped abilities in our mind that we don't know how to utilize. And I'm still a little skeptical on psychokinesis, you know, manipulating objects. I know there have been a couple people in the past. I know there was this Russian gal, I don't know, remember her name. It was like Nina Kulingina or whatever, who was studied to ignite matches in an enclosed thing. And her heart rate would get all crazy, so she would have to stop when she was trying to do it. But I'm still a little skeptical. Is there any evidence that's relatively conclusive that shows that we actually can, like, move objects with our mind?
Yeah, actually there is, and there are things that you can do yourself. Now, as odd as it sounds, I'm just going to list a few of these things. As odd as it sounds, you know, everybody's familiar with Uri Geller, who, of course, in the 1970s and the early 80s was all over television, stopped watches and bending keys and bending spoons and all that sort of thing. That's the entertainment value portion of the program there. But what a lot of people don't realize is how much research has actually gone into study of psychokinesis and how that can actually be done by most people, how it is just like a muscle. The more you do it, the better you get with it. So you actually can. This was a big thing in the late 80s or the early 90s with major corporations. They would do team building sessions where you would, you know, if you worked for a major corporation, you'd go to a hotel ballroom with 100 of your coworkers and you'd all be screaming at the cutlery and willing it to bend, and suddenly, you know, your spoon turns into a corkscrew, that sort of thing. There's a lot of again, anecdotal evidence for those kinds of things. Martin Kaden, who was a wonderful author and researcher in paranormal phenomena, he wrote Cyborg, actually the book upon which the $6 million man was based. He developed a little tool that people can put together for themselves that he called a psi wheel, which is basically just taking a bell jar, and in the bell jar you put a little spindle, like put a little block of clay, you put a little spindle in it, you take a little square of paper and you fold it into a little pyramid shape, put it on top of that spindle, and then you put the whole thing under glass and you concentrate on it, willing it to spin one direction or another direction. And it turns out that a lot of people can actually do this, and it isn't due to stray air currents or thermal convection or electrostatic things. You can control for all of those things. I've done it myself. I actually teach a class in doing these kinds of things, and students are really amazed when they're able to do this, because they're just concentrating on it from across the room, and the thing begins to spin. You can do those sorts of things. Those are the little things. Random number generators are probably one of the better examples that we have of this. The Global Consciousness Project is one of those things. For decades, there has been a study that has been undertaken in putting random event generators, random number generators around the world, and they're monitored basically 24/7. And the long and the short of it is that when the world as a whole goes through periods of upheaval or joy, extremes of emotion that are felt on a global scale. The random number generators around the world start tending away from randomness. So the numbers that are coming back, basically it's tending towards order, which should not happen. That's according to physics, that should not be possible. So when we have events like 9/11, when we have events like the terrible terrorist attacks that we've had in the last year or two, or shootings or things like this, it's as if the whole world is feeling these things, and that concentration, that intent at such a large level, at such a large scale, is actually picked up by these random number generators around the world. They're able to do this actually with one particular event every year like clockwork. Doesn't have to be a spontaneous thing, but every year everybody celebrates the turning of the year, so New Year's Eve. And what they're able to do is, as people begin to celebrate New Year's Eve, everybody's together on the same page, time zone by time zone, they can start to see changes in the random number generators, tending away from randomness as each time zone gets closer to midnight. And I think that's a fascinating thing. So there's more evidence that we are able to physically affect the environment using nothing but intention. You don't always have to know that you're actually using psychokinesis, because it's kind of running in the background all the time. One of the other effects that we can kind of point to as evidence for psychokinesis is what's known as RSPK, which is recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. And this is actually what we commonly call poltergeist phenomena. Up until the 70s or so, poltergeists were really generally believed to be a type of ghost, a mischievous spirit, of course, the noisy spirit, that's what the word poltergeist means, that you basically attract somehow into your home or your workspace, and it follows you around, creating all kinds of very disruptive behavior. It will play havoc with your electronic devices, or it will break dishes, or it will bang very loudly and slam doors, all kinds of very, very disruptive, disturbing physical phenomena. Starting in the 70s and into the 80s, several researchers, including Dr. William Roll and Barry Taff, were able to get in sort of on the ground floor of some of these spontaneous cases of disturbances. And what they discovered was that there was less evidence showing up that suggested an apparition, and much more evidence that pointed to a living person there in the dynamic of say the family or the work environment. There was usually one person at the center of all of that disruptive behavior that was going on, and that person sort of fit a particular profile, a psychological profile. And it turns out that, according to parapsychology today, the model that we use to explain poltergeist phenomena is that living agent, that one person at the center of the storm of activity, is subconsciously creating that activity themselves using psychokinesis. Again, completely unconsciously, subconsciously, usually, as we believe, in response to extraordinary stresses in their life. You know, the Rosenheim case that happened back in the 1960s, 1970s, the young girl who hated her job. All of a sudden, you know, for weeks on end, the office would be torn apart. The phones would go haywire. Chandeliers would swing, all this sort of thing. The phone system would automatically dial into the time phone number, you know, the phone number you used to call to get the correct time. Thousands of calls every minute. There's no way that humans can do that. You can't dial that many numbers that fast and that sort of thing. So basically what it was saying was that this girl disliked her job so much that it was leaking out of her in these psychokinetic effects. The
wow.
thing is with RSPK, with poltergeist cases, if you're able to get the agent, the person at the center of all of this stuff, to make the connection, to realize that they are actually the ones doing it, rather than just coming out and pointing the finger at them, because that just that makes things worse. But if you're actually able to get them to make that connection that they are the ones responsible for it, the activity generally stops like right on the spot. And there's some really good evidence, but that's not an apparition. That's probably psychokinesis at work. So to answer your question in a really long roundabout way, yeah, there really is a lot of evidence. A lot of evidence suggesting that psychokinesis, that mind over matter or mind matter interactions really do exist and are a usable thing, that we actually can train ourselves to be able to use this.
Now, I know there's going to be detractors out there. Probably one of the most famous against psychic phenomena is James Randi, who debunks all these people, even like Uri Geller, and it's all, you know, magic tricks and stuff like that. And I've watched a lot of videos on YouTube where James Randi, you know, because he has this $1 million challenge thing. If anybody can prove to him that, you know, psychic powers are real, he'll pay them $1 million. And I think we might have even talked about this last time we talked to you. But I just find it kind of fascinating that, you know, he's dedicated his life to this and that nobody has claimed the $1 million prize, you know, that's just sitting out there, because nobody can prove, at least, you know, following his guidelines, that there is actually a psychic phenomenon?
Yeah. One of the things that you've got to be aware of with the amazing James Randi, number one, he has absolutely no scientific background whatsoever. He's a stage magician and an entertainer, all right? Now, he's a very good one, but if I'm looking for scientific proof or scientific evidence of psychic phenomena, he's probably not the first person on my list to have on a panel of judges, okay? I'd want some people from, you know, the area of physics and the area of biology and neuroscience and things like that. One of the other things you need to understand about James Randi is that the $1 million challenge, as he called it, you said it just a minute ago, you had to prove to him, to Randi, to his satisfaction, that psychic phenomena are real. Nobody else. There was no panel at any time. So in other words, if you are going to take on the challenge and you're going to go and try to prove these things, you're doing it to Randi's specifications, which were never particularly stated in any form that was consistent. So it was as if the rules changed from challenge to challenge. One of the other things that you have to know about Randi is that if you go, and you can Google this, there are several articles that detail instances where people have actually tried to prove, to perform for him in whatever form of psychic phenomena that it does exist, where he has actually backed out of the challenge himself. There was a famous case that happened with a medical study that was going to be done with psychic healing. And they had actually gotten the okay from the Randi Foundation. And the Randi Foundation had said, you don't even need to fill out the forms, you know, because usually there's this whole set of forms and paperwork that has to be done. They said, you've got, you know, you guys are scientists, you're in the field of medicine, you're renting out this entire hospital, you're doing controls. This looks like a great experiment. Don't even worry about the paperwork. So the people that were doing the challenge themselves, they actually went through all of the steps to get the hospital, to get the time, the laboratory time, and everything set up. And within, I think, a few weeks of the challenge date that had been agreed upon, the foundation said, well, we don't know anything about this. You didn't file any paperwork. And it was too late to do that. And by the way, we've looked at your protocols and it's all garbage, so we're not even going to accept your challenge. Things like this are actually fairly common with the Randi Foundation and other groups that do that. Now, my personal feeling is that I think Randi has done a little more damage to the field of parapsychology than good with regard to, as you say, debunking the hoaxers and the frauds, and believe me, there are a lot of them out there, and I'm all for getting actual solid scientific evidence for this stuff. But you have to understand that stage magicians notwithstanding, even mainstream scientists, physicists, neuroscientists, all of these kinds of these fields of study, they reject the idea of paranormal phenomena, even when they are given studies that have been done in controlled conditions that have been repeated, because the problem of replicability has been one of the scapegoats for debunkers for years. Actually, there is repeated evidence repeated with studies and whatnot. Even if you hand them these studies, they will either look at it and just kind of shrug their shoulders and not say much, or they will refuse to actually read the studies. There was one brilliant quote that came out several years ago. I forget who the physicist was, but he was given a study that was conclusive, basically, of the phenomena that had been looked at. Several different studies had been done and basically had shown that these phenomena did exist, at least at the statistical level, that there was significance happening there. He looked at it, he read it, and he said, "This is the kind of thing I wouldn't believe even if it were true." Hmm. That's an incredible statement for a scientist to make, that even if the evidence is staring you right in the face, we have evidence of ghosts, we have evidence of poltergeists, we have evidence of telepathy, even if the stuff is real, I'm not going to believe it. There's a lot of peer pressure, you know, that goes on in the scientific community. So you kind of have to weed through all of those, and you can't really take a lot of this at face value. You have to dig for the true information behind it.
Well, I imagine people that are, you know, scientists working in the traditional areas of science, they're probably, you know, get the people that are doing the parapsychology probably aren't looked at as being serious or legitimate, and there's probably a ton of skepticism. I think a little skepticism is good, but I'm totally with you. I'm certain in my mind that our minds have the ability to do more than we're aware of. I've had many instances in my life where, you know, strange things have happened, and I totally believe about manifesting one's reality and stuff like that. So it would be great if there was, and maybe there is, if there's some sort of exercise program that somebody could use to kind of harness and amplify these abilities to make it really useful in the daily life. Is there something like that? Now, you mentioned that psychic thing for psychic kinesis, the wheel thingy. Are there programs out there that help people develop, you know, ESP or psychic kinesis, psychokinesis and stuff like that?
Yeah, actually, you know, we talked about the remote viewing program at the Stargate Project. A lot of the star performers, if you will, Ingo Swann and McMonagall and all of those folks, who basically showed without a doubt that they had the ability to remote view time and time again and very accurately. You know, they've written books. They do the lecture thing, and they also teach classes. You can buy DVDs of them and telling you what their techniques are and how to do these things for yourself and make it a practical thing that you can do on your own. There's really not a lot of magic to this. Again, you just have to have the controls. If people want to learn precognition, for instance, to have that foresight, that foreknowledge, one of the best things that you can do is the next time that you have a premonition or a feeling, usually these things come in dreams. So people who are very good with dreams or do dream journals are kind of ahead of the curve on this sort of thing. If you want to prove to yourself that precognition exists and that you have the ability to do that, start documenting every single time you get a premonition that something is going to happen. And then if that event happens, you've got proof. There is your evidence. I wrote it down. I dated it. I had it witnessed. I told somebody else about it. That's actually very easy, you know, to do. And the more you do it, it's like I said before, it's kind of like going to the gym. You can go to the gym and work out. Not everybody's going to turn into, you know, a world-class Arnold Schwarzenegger bodybuilder. But you will strengthen yourself, and you will be better than when you went into the gym the first time. And the same thing seems to hold true with psychic ability. If you want to learn how to strengthen your psychokinesis ability or your precognitive ability, your remote viewing ability, your telepathic ability, there are actually very simple ways of going about doing this. You can actually, online, if you look at places like the Parapsychological Association, the Parapsychology Foundation, they all have little guidelines for you. If you go and you Google Dean Radin, one of the foremost researchers in parapsychology today, works at IONS. He's got a number of little tricks and tips for you to develop these kinds of things. The information's out there, but usually what I caution people to do is to make sure that you're getting it from a reputable source. So if these people have worked with parapsychologists, if they've worked with actual paranormal research in a laboratory setting, chances are they've got a really good track record, and their techniques are probably, you know, pretty valid. So it doesn't really take that much. It really doesn't take that much. Mostly you just have to have an open mind, because it does seem, again, from years of looking into these phenomena, that the more that you believe you're able to do psi phenomena, the better you will be at doing it. If you don't believe that you can do these things, that you can't have telepathy and you don't have precognition, then you score lower on these kinds of tests. So it does seem that just your own attitude toward the subject matter actually affects your ability, whether you can or cannot do these things, which is a very important key thing for people to keep in mind.
And that makes sense. I was wondering, I just thought of a quick question here. For somebody that's adept at one of these areas of, you know, psychic powers, has anybody ever hooked up like an EEG to their brain and like documented changes in the electrical activity inside the brain?
Multiple times. One of the ones that comes to mind is Dr. Joyce Hawks, who's a cellular biologist who did not believe in paranormal phenomena, before she had a life-changing event and then became aware that she herself did have psychic ability, including energetic healing, which is considered to be part of psychic ability, energy healing or distance healing. I saw some of the clips from a documentary that were done with her taking part in some tests in Japan where they did hook her up, as you say, to an EEG, an electroencephalogram, to see what her brain waves were doing while she was running energy, while she was sort of going through the steps that she would go through if she was with a client or a patient to do the energy work. And it turns out that, yeah, various areas of the brain that generally aren't used by us in daily processes started lighting up, and that they were actually getting significant output of gamma waves. You know, the four main brain wave states that we have are beta, alpha, theta, and delta in that order. And there are some other levels, gamma being one of them. And it does seem that a lot of healers enter gamma state when they're in their healing process, when they're doing their healing process. So, yeah, these kinds of things are done. People have thought about doing them. And they do continue to be done. So, you know, there is evidence out there for it.
And that, to me, adds validity to the whole thing, you know, when you can take a scientific instrument and something changes from the baseline, something different is happening, it kind of adds credence to it in my book. What do you think
Absolutely.
About that, Sherry?
Yes, that's true. It's amazing how the mind can, you know, everything's energy. And the way I feel is that, you know, when you project, whether it's positive or negative, your energy, your body can take you in any places that you wish. It's just a matter of having confidence and being able to say, this is what I'm going to do. I mean, as an example, you know, I've worked with a pendulum years ago, and I can manipulate the pendulum, just like Neil was saying. I can manipulate the pendulum to go back and forth, you know, make some circles, stop, and this and that. It's amazing how your mind can actually move things.
Well, it's like Jason said earlier, you know, the about the brain and the mind, you know, we've got this organ in our heads that we've mapped and we understand what it does physically. But we don't understand what the mind is. There isn't a neuroscientist on the planet that can tell you what consciousness is. We don't know whether the brain is a function of the mind or the mind is a function of the brain or both. So how can we say for sure that we don't have these abilities, that they aren't tucked somewhere back in our, either in our brain or in our consciousness somewhere, and that we're able to bring them forth and use them? And Sherry, of course, brings up an excellent point from a cosmological or a physics point of view. Reality is energy. That's what it is. Energy is information. Information is energy. That's what physics is about. So, yeah, you know, whether people want to believe it or not, you're interacting with energy on a daily basis when you're touching matter, when you're thinking, when you're using your consciousness every day. You're doing nothing but using energy on an ongoing basis.
Absolutely.
Very true. Well, we have a few minutes left. We've got about 10 minutes left. And I wanted to ask you, kind of off the subject, because it's a subject that I hold dearest to my heart. What's your stance on UFOs, real or fake?
Well, okay, my disclaimer is that on a professional level, parapsychology doesn't look into UFOs or aliens. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. It's just that that's not part of what parapsychology is. On a personal level, yes, I do believe in UFOs. I do believe that extraterrestrial life exists, probably in abundance throughout the universe. Have they come here? Have they done that? I have no idea. I can't say for sure. I myself have seen what I considered to be a UFO just a few years ago. Actually, it was this time of year. It was about 5 or 6 years ago on Christmas Day night. I was actually having dinner in my living room, looked out the window, and saw what I considered to be a UFO over Seattle. And it actually corroborated with a number of other sightings that had happened in the same 2 or 3 day period. So I do believe that UFOs exist. And having said that, I believe in the literal translation of UFO, which is unidentified flying object. It means that there's an object in the sky, it's flying, and we cannot identify it. That's what a UFO is to me. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's extraterrestrial.
Absolutely, and I'm sure the governments around the world, well, particularly the United States government, has technology that we're not aware of and is flying around. But I got to ask, what did that thing over Seattle look like?
Interestingly enough, it was an orange ball. It sort of had a yellow center that pulsed. It moved at a variable speed, was really, really fast, and it could change altitude fairly, fairly quickly. We watched it for maybe 2 minutes at the most. And I've got a friend and colleague, Peter Davenport, who runs one of the national UFO reporting networks out of Eastern Washington. And in talking with him about my experience and the time at which it happened, he said that according to his research, that those particular sightings were on the increase around that time and for the next 6 months or so after that in the Pacific Northwest and across the rest of the U.S. Interestingly enough, he told me that his center received something like maybe up to 300 calls or inquiries a month at the center. During this period, he said it went up to over 1,000, which is an enormous leap. And all of them, he said, almost all of them without exception, were reporting these orange balls of light, usually in pairs or in triplets. So I found that to be absolutely rather fascinating. So, there it is again. They're unidentified, they're flying, they're objects, and a lot of people are seeing them, what they are, and we have no idea.
Very interesting. Well, we do still have a couple minutes left now. If somebody wanted to learn more about you or contact you, how would they go about doing that?
That's really easy. They can actually go to Paranormal Studies, all one word, paranormalstudies.org. That's my main website. And they can take a look at what I think about paranormal phenomena. I've got all kinds of links on there, and I do have a calendar of events because, I teach classes and appear at conferences and things like that. I believe I'll be at the Oregon Ghost Conference coming up next year, and I will also be down in Portland, I believe, on Memorial Day weekend, talking about ghosts and whatnot for the McMinimans Paranormal Pub series. They can also find me on Facebook. They can either find me as Neil McNeil or Paranormal Studies, and they can look at it that way.
Where's that McMinimans? What location is that going to be at for the Paranormal Pub series?
The Paranormal Pub, that will be at the Mission Theater, I believe, is the one, that beautiful old theater that they've converted and have their talks at on a monthly basis. Great, great location. I've spoken there before.
They have some great locations. A lot of them reputed to be haunted. I did an investigation at the Edgefield out in Troutdale, which is one of their locations. Actually, I also did...
Yeah.
The White Eagle, I don't know if that's a McMinimans or not, but very interesting locations. But we got to wrap it up. Neil, I want to thank you so much for taking your time to come in on Paranormal Horizons tonight, and hopefully we can talk to you again in the future. We have a lot to talk about.
My pleasure, and again, I really appreciate you and Sherry having me back anytime.
Thank you, Neil. You are wonderful. So refreshing to hear just a different take of the paranormal. You know, it's amazing. You're wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Neil. Happy holidays.
You too. Take care. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I really like the science. You know, I'm kind of skeptical, as you know, Sherry. I've made it no secret to the listeners, but I'm open-minded. I've seen enough strange things in my times, from UFOs to doing ghost investigations. And I know in my heart that there are a lot of explanations for things, you know, like pareidolia and just stuff like that. But I also know and acknowledge the fact that there are some things out there that we simply can't explain explain as of now, you know, with the current state of technology. But it is very interesting. There's a lot of strange things that go on out there, and I'm going to keep trying and forcing myself and educating myself to keep my eyes open so that maybe I can have a better understanding of some of the strangeness out there.
It's all great. To me, it's all learning and expanding our horizons and just, you know, learning and becoming more aware and growing spiritually and emotionally and mentally. So it's wonderful. I love it. I love just learning and just, you know, it's just great. I can't put it into words. Let's put it that way.
It's an amazing world we live in. So what do we got coming up next week?
Okay, so Guy Belanta from Hawaii, Hawaiian Huntings. Going to come out and talk about, we're not sure, I think we were talking about something different, I'm not sure, I forgot, it's been a while, but I'll talk with him, and we're going to talk about Hawaii, or we're going to talk about something about the paranormal or spiritual. So, you know, I'm pretty open to that, but I know that with him coming on, it's going to be a very, very good show. So, and in 2 weeks from now, that will be for the holidays, we're going to welcome back Paul Coffey. Paul is in South, what is it, Texas, south of Texas, paranormal. He's one of the top paranormal teams in the United States. Guy is really well-versed in I wouldn't say exorcisms, but just dealing with demons and crossing people over. So we're going to talk about something different with Paul. It's been a long time since we've had him on the show, but we welcome him back, and we also welcome Guy Belanta next week.
Yeah, Paul is really fun to talk to. And well, I guess with that, I want to thank everybody for listening. And if you haven't, to check out our Facebook page, Paranormal Horizons on Facebook. And also want to thank KITC-FM and KNCP radio stations in Central Oregon for rebroadcasting this show on Thursday. And unless you have anything else, Sherry, we'll see everybody next Sunday, 8 p.m. West Coast time.
I don't have anything else to say, but everybody take care, be safe, and peace to all, each and every one of you. And thank you so much for your support. We appreciate you.
Absolutely. Good night, and hope everybody has a safe week. Good night, everyone.
Take care. Bye-bye.